My wife and I worked in North Africa in a restricted access nation, which means that we weren't allowed to be missionaries in that country under penalty of being kicked out of the country. And so I typically will use a pseudonym for a lot of things now, but I've gone back to using my full name a little bit more because a couple of years ago, I went back into Morocco where we were living, and my wife and I were on a boat, and we're traveling over from southern Spain. We'd been doing some stuff in southern Spain, and we went through and we stamped our passports, and the policeman was really nice, and we went back and sat down in our seats, and I said to my wife, I said, see, there's not any problem with us going back into Morocco, because they had just kind of thrown a whole bunch of people out. And the next thing I know, the police officer comes up and he says, Mr. Clausen, do you have a car on the boat? And I thought, well, that's a normal question. I didn't fill out any paperwork on a car. And I said, no, sir, I don't have a car. And then he said, well, have you ever had a problem in Morocco? And I said, no, sir, I've never had a problem in Morocco. I love Morocco and love being there and love the people of Morocco. Thank you. And he said, well, you have a problem now. And I said, well, how can I have a problem now? And he said, you have to get off the boat right now. And the purser was standing next to him, and you could hear the boat engines, man, they were roaring as it was getting ready to leave, and they were trying to leave on time. And he grabbed me, and we walked off the boat really, really fast. And he said, you are no longer welcome in Morocco. And that was a depressing day because I love the Moroccan people and I love the country of Morocco, but I am no longer allowed to step foot inside that country legally. I've thought about going illegally, but I wasn't sure what would happen if I did that. So I've resisted the temptation. The last time I tried again this last summer, and this time I got on the boat, but I didn't fill out my paperwork until the boat had left. The first time it was still in the port on the Spanish side. So this time I decided, well, I'm gonna wait until we get into open water. That way they can't kick me off, right? Or at least I hope they wouldn't kick me off in the middle of the straits there. And so I got on and filled out my paperwork, and we got to the port of Tangier and landed in Tangier. And they came up and said, Mr. Clausen, have you ever had a problem in Morocco? And I said, well, not really in Morocco. And he said, well, you still have a problem, and kept me on the boat and didn't let me out. And I thought about jumping, but I wasn't sure how I'd ever get home again, so I didn't. But it's hard to not be able to go back to a place that you love and a place where you have a lot of really, really incredible memories. I'll show you real quickly a picture of my wife and myself in one of our favorite places. This is kind of my screenshot on my computer. This is my wife, Sherry, and that's me. Whoa, what happened? Huh. We're searching. Okay, here we go. That's in the Sahara Desert, one of the most beautiful places in the entire world. Is the Sahara Desert, and you see that orange sand. It is just like that, and it is a phenomenal place, and we love being there. So I want to thank you guys for coming this morning and for being a part of this time. We're going to talk about going to the nations and being willing to do whatever it takes to get to the nations. And I don't think there's anything better than being a part and being out amongst the nations and sharing the gospel with them. So what I want to do first is I have five books. It's a Southern Baptist, it's a Southern Seminary guide to evangelism. I wrote the chapter on evangelism to Muslims. And so I've got five that I'm going to give away. And I'm going to ask you some questions. So the people who get the questions we'll get a book, all right? But you're going to have to raise your hand real quick, and it's not going to be real fair, all right? Now, we know what 7 billion is, right? What is 7 billion? This isn't for a book because this one's too easy. What would 7 billion represent? World population, that's right. So we think about the fact that in the world today, there are 7 billion people. Now, that's a lot of folks, isn't it? That is a lot of people. And we think about the fact that as followers of Jesus, we have a responsibility to get the gospel to 7 billion people. Well, 7 billion is kind of one of those numbers that I don't even know what it means, right? I don't have a clue as to what 7 billion means. So we break it down and we come to 6549, 6,549. Now, I'm not going to give anybody a book for this one either because this one's too easy too. So anybody have an idea of what 6,549 is? That's the number of what kind of people group?
Unreached
people groups. That's right. So there are 6,549 unreached people groups. That means that less than 2% of their population is evangelical. Now, actually, that number 2% is pretty high. Doesn't sound high to us, does it? But 2% in some places of the world seems like a lot more. Where we worked, we were at 0.001% of the population being Christian. In other words, in a country of 30 million people, there were less than 100 Christians, less than 100 amongst the whole 30 million people. So that creates quite a job. Now, this one I'm going to give a book for. Who knows what 3,056 is? What does 3,056 stand for? Yes. Okay, well, that's close. When we think about different kinds of people, that would be in this number. What about in this number? Any ideas? If this is unengaged people groups, what would this one be? No, not engaged. That's a good guess, though. We're going to give you credit for that. No, not reached. Groups, well, we'll talk about that in a minute. Almost. We're almost there. Almost, almost. Oh, come on. I got to give away a book here. Unengaged and unreached people groups. Very good. So there are 3,056 who are unengaged. What that means is with these, there is gospel presence and people are trying to share the gospel with them. But there are over 3,000 people groups where nobody's even trying to share the gospel with them. They are unengaged. No one is working with them. Now, that's a lot, and yet that's not many, is it? Think about the number of churches, even Southern Baptist churches in the United States are some 45,000. Well, there's only 3,000 unengaged, unreached people groups. Any idea as to why? In our world today, when we can get around so fast and you can tweet a message and it's all over the world instantly, why would there still be 3,056 unengaged, unreached people groups?
Fear.
Fear is one of the reasons. That's right. People are afraid to go. They're in hard places. They're in places like North Korea, where you got a crazy dictator who's killing Christians for sharing the gospel. That's one of the reasons. What's another reason? Well, in some cases, well, that's a lot of them. They don't want to hear the gospel. That's right. So they're resistant. They push away, and they don't let people come to them. They're engaging in something else. That's right. They are involved in lots of different religions and lots of different practices. Some of these people groups, they're just hard to get to. Some of them are down in the Amazon basin of Brazil. And in order to get to them, you've got to get in a canoe and you've got to canoe down the Amazon for days at a time and get back into the most awfulest of jungle places. I'm not a jungle guy, I got to understand. Give me 50 radical Muslims, I'm happy. Give me spiders and snakes, I'm not into that at all. All right, just 50 radical Muslims, gotcha. Snakes and spiders, no interest whatsoever. If I die for the gospel, I want to die for the gospel, not because a snake ate me, right? That's just kind of my theory on the whole thing. But, you know, some of them are there. I mean, they are like in the middle of the jungle, and you've got to walk for days in order to get to them. Or they're in really hard places in the Sahara Desert or in other deserts or other places of Africa that are still hard for us to reach into. So they're unengaged for a reason, but we have a responsibility to get the gospel to them, don't we? All right, very good. Okay, let me ask you another question. We'll go ahead and give away a book for this. 6,900. 6,900. Think about a Bible. We're going to move to some Bible translation statistics. What could 6,900 be? Almost. 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 Any ideas? We wish. Yes. Almost. We're getting close. No, I wish. All right. 6,900 represents the number of languages in the world today. All right? That's the number of languages that are out there in the world. Now, we're still thinking Bible translation, so think about all of your other answers. I'm going to help you here. So we have 6,900 languages in the world today, approximately. Now, understand that that number fluctuates. All right? Because when I was working overseas, Wycliffe Bible translators would come to me and say, hey, John, I need you to go and talk and find out if this people group have their own language. And we would go to that people group and we would talk to them and we would try and determine if they had a language. We would think that they did, so they might be here. Then we'd go to them and we'd find out that they don't have a language. Or we'd find out that there are actually two languages amongst that people group, right? So that number fluctuates as we're trying to find this 3,056 people groups. Okay? So we're thinking Bible translation. What would 513 be? Yes. Okay, full Bibles that are translated. Now, I want you guys to think about that for a minute. There are 6,900 languages, and how many languages have a full Bible? Now, I don't know about you guys, but that bugs the dickens out of me. Did you know that the English Bible's been translated over 500 times into English? There are 513 languages that have the whole Bible out of 6,900. Okay, what would 1,900 plus be? Almost. No. Come on, I got three more books here. Okay, that is the number of languages that have absolutely nothing translated into their language. Now think about that. They don't have John 3:16. They don't have anything in their language. Nothing. All right. 1,010. Who said that? All right. Partial. There you go. Oh, you already got a book. Oh, man. Okay. Well, here, you give it to somebody. Okay. There are 1,010 that have partial. This is actually 1,010 that just have pieces of Scripture. If you take these two numbers and subtract it, or add and the 513, you get the number that have then whole New Testaments. Okay, so just do a little bit of addition, you can get the whole New Testament. 180 million, what would that represent? No, no. That would, well, dialects, that's actually a pretty good guess, because a dialect is different from a language. 180 million. Think about that number. Need to give away my book here. 180 million people that have no contact with the Bible, no translation. That's right. Would you pass that back? That 180 million people represents the 1,900 plus people groups that have zero in their language. Yes?
I do have a question. Mm-hmm. In Africa, I hear that some people know like 10 different languages.
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean that, what if they have, is that still counting like all the languages together?
That's a great question. That's a really, really good question because you are right. Most of my friends in North Africa just grew up speaking 3 to 4 languages. My son, Andre, he speaks 3 languages fluently. Without thinking about it, he can speak 3 languages. And you're right, there are people who speak 9 and 10 languages. The question is how do we level fluency? What does your mom speak to you? That's really the question. We talk about heart language. When you're at home, what language do you speak? Imagine if you speak multiple languages, but in those multiple languages, your heart language has no Bible in it. All right? So the only way that you guys can read a Bible is to read it in Spanish. So you have to go to school and you have to study in Spanish, right? You're going to have to learn this other language in order to speak it. But let's say you get up to an 80% proficiency, which is a really high proficiency level of another language, right? That means, though, that 20% you don't understand. But that 20% is usually the hardest words. So if you take any verse in the Bible, take out 20% of the words, or take out 20% of the words in Scripture, but the big words like salvation and redemption and those big words, you take those out, it's going to be really hard to understand the Word of God, isn't it? So that's why it's so important that we get it into their language. So that's an excellent, excellent question, because that is the question. Well, why don't they just use this other translation? Well, it's because while they understand the majority of it, they don't necessarily understand all of it. And then the other beautiful thing is when we put it into their heart language. So we worked with the Reef Berbers in North Africa. And the Reef Berbers, their language had been forbidden. All right, it was against the law to write it or to speak it under the king that was living at that time. Now imagine if a king came in or a dictator came into the United States and said, you can no longer speak English. The only language you can speak is French. Heaven forbid, that would be awful. The only language you can speak is French. So all of you guys have to start going to school in French. Whenever you read anything, it has to be in French. And English is prohibited. Everything on TV is now in French. All of the books that were in English have been burned and destroyed. And if the police catch you speaking English, they'll slap you, they'll hit you, they'll beat you. Okay? What would you think of French at that point? Would you like French? No. So when I would work with my Reef Berber friends and we would speak Arabic together, after we got done speaking Arabic, they would spit just to get the Arabic out of their mouth. They didn't like it, right? So we started translating the Bible into their language. It was the coolest thing. Because we would give them Bible. I mean, we were giving them the scriptures. And these were all heavy Muslims, right? They were Muslims. And when they would hear it in their language, they would get so excited. And they would come, they would walk miles to come and get scripture from us, which they weren't supposed to have, just because it was in their language. One time we took the book of Daniel and we published it in their script so they could read it. And we put a cassette with it. You know how you listen to, when you guys were kids, when you were real little, you would listen to a book on cassette and follow along with the words and stuff like that. Well, that's what we did. And we passed it out, and this was the first time that some of them had ever seen their language written out. All right? And it was so much fun. They were opening up the book, and they were looking at the letters, and they would sound out a word, because they knew the letters. They knew how to read, but it was in another language, right? So they knew the concept of reading, so they would sound out the word. They would read, mumshtijid. Mumshtijid. And you'd see this light bulb go off in their heads. And they would read, mumshtijid, and they'd get this smile on their face because they just read their language. Now, isn't that cool? That was like one of the coolest things in the whole wide world. So we think about these numbers and we realize that there are people who need the gospel, but the gospel's not even in their language yet. What a responsibility you guys have as a generation to get the gospel to these people. We think about the fact that there are 6,500 language UPGs that have very little access to the gospel. What a responsibility we have to get the gospel to them. Over 3,000 that have no one trying to get the gospel to them. What a responsibility we have. In Romans 10, we have this really cool passage that Paul writes. And he writes and he says to us, he says, "Brethren, my heart's desire and my prayer for God for them," and he's writing about the Jews, "is for their salvation. For I testify about them, they have a zeal for God, but not in accordance with knowledge. For not knowing about God's righteousness and seeking to establish their own, they did not subject themselves to the righteousness of God. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes. For Moses writes that the man who practices the righteousness which is based on the law shall live by that righteousness. But the righteousness based on faith speaks as follows: Do not say in your heart, who will ascend to heaven, that is to bring Christ down. Who will descend into the abyss, that is to bring Christ up from the dead. But what does it say? The word is near you in your mouth and in your heart, that is the word of faith which we are preaching. That if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, then you'll be saved. For with the heart a person believes, resulting in righteousness, and with the mouth confession results in salvation. For the scripture says, whoever believes in him will not be disappointed. For there is no distinction between Jew and Greek. The same Lord is Lord of all, abounding in riches for all who call on him. For whoever will call on the name of the Lord will be saved. And how will they call on him in whom they have not believed? How will they believe in him in whom they have not heard? And how will they hear without a preacher? How will they preach unless they are sent? Just as it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news of good things." Paul starts out in chapter 10 and he says, "My brethren, my heart's desire, my prayer to God for them is for their salvation." And I like the passion that Paul has as he's concluding chapter 9 and jumping into chapter 10. And he talks about this passion, this heart. He says that I testify about them that they have a zeal for God, but not in accordance with knowledge. You know, so many of the people groups that we run into in the world today, they have a zeal for God, but it's a zeal without knowledge. And they need to have a knowledge. They need to hear the truth of the gospel. And so many of them are wanting to hear. I remember now you guys are all way too young, but if you'll talk to your parents and your youth leaders, they might talk to you about a time in our world in 1979. I know that was decades ago. I realize that. And you just got to understand I'm old. So just let me go with it, all right? 1979, there was a terrible crisis in the United States. There were oil embargoes and all kinds of bad stuff was happening. And one of the really bad things that happened was in Iran, they overthrew the government and overthrew our embassy. And when they overthrew our embassy, they took our Americans hostages. And Iran became this radical nation focused only on Islam. And the ruler of Iran no longer was a political leader, but a religious leader, the Ayatollahs. And if you read in the news today, you can read about the Ayatollahs of Iran. And they're radical. And in some respects, they're crazy. They are radical and have zeal for God, but they don't know God. But God is doing amazing things in Iran. Watch this video. Now, Iran is former Babylon, right? You think about Daniel.
In the heart of Central Asia is a country rich in cultural history. For centuries, Iran represented a Persian heritage of artistic and architectural contributions. But in recent years, the political climate of the nation has evoked stereotypes that depict an entirely different image of the Iranian people and their country.
New generation, they are, most of them are educated people, educated persons. So they are not fanatic. Iranian people are very warm. and they're always welcome to foreigners.
The people living in Iran are like any kind of people living in any other country.
Fear of the government of Iran should not keep believers from reaching out to the Iranian people with the gospel. They are loved by God, and He has a plan for them despite the man-made barriers of religious persecution and cultural fear of straying from Islam.
Now, Islam is losing its power among Iranian society.
But unfortunately, the biggest problem is their heart is empty.
So they want to fill their emptiness, their empty hearts, through some temporary solutions, like drugs, like sex, or immoral things.
Even though there are definite barriers to spreading the gospel in Iran, God is working in the hearts of Iranians in the country and abroad. If we, as God's people, will pray for Iran and give to international missions, God will use those resources to break down barriers so that the gospel can be shared with the people of Iran. Take this opportunity right now to join God's movement in reaching all nations and unmasking the stereotypes.
This is the best time for Iran to turn to God.
So we think about a place like Iran where, man, the gospel is hard. And it is hard to share the gospel in that country. But there are people who are seeking. There are people who have a zeal for God, but they don't know God. And there are these countries all over the world. I remember one time we were working in North Africa, and we were actually at that time in a Spanish enclave city. What that means is on the continent of Africa, there was this little tiny city, and all the way around the city there was a big fence. The city itself was Spanish. The other side of the fence was Morocco, right? So it was in Morocco, but it was a Spanish city. So we were working in that city for a while, and I met this man one day. It was the middle of the summer, and I met this man, and I just happened to be out that day. We had just had a big group of young people who had come in, and we'd been showing Jesus films, and we'd been handing out these materials that I was talking to you about. Man, it had been a great week because people were so excited about the materials. It had just been a blast. I was exhausted. You know, I mean, we're talking about 15, 18-hour days, it felt like, every single day, because when volunteers would come in, we'd work hard with those volunteers, but it was fun. And it was that next Monday, we had a week between teams, and I had a volunteer apartment, and I ran into this guy. Now, he was about this tall, and he couldn't have weighed 100 pounds dripping wet, right? I mean, there's just nothing to him. And for some reason, God told me I needed to talk to him. But I had a real problem because he didn't speak any language that I spoke. I spoke two languages at the time, but he didn't speak, or I spoke three languages at the time, but he didn't speak any of those languages. And now that's frustrating when you learn all these languages and you can't talk to somebody, right? Well, all I knew is that he was in really bad shape. So I got him food and I took him to the apartment. It was in the evening. I took him to the apartment. I got him lots of food and I got him water and stuff to drink and took care of him. And I said, listen, you can stay here. He didn't understand me, but he knew that he was safe, right? So I put him there in the apartment. The next morning, I get up to go check on him because I know he's not legal, right? I know he's not legal in the country. And so I go to check to see, you know, what's going on here. So I walk in. Now, the thing you got to understand about people who live in the Sahara is that when they were little, they broke their thermostats in their bodies. I really believe that because it was the middle of summer and he had like four wool blankets over him. And it's just the weirdest thing ever. You know, your blood just gets thin. That's why when it's cold out here, man, I'd much rather be in the Sahara. It's so much nicer. Gets cold here. I'm just cold all the time, right? So he had these four blankets over him. Now remember, he didn't weigh 90 pounds soaking wet, right? So there's just not much to him. 4 wool blankets over the top of him. I go to check on him, and he's completely covered. He has them up over their head, his head. How many of you guys like to sleep with your blankets over your head? All right, a couple of you guys do. So he had it all the way over his head. Now imagine my thoughts as I walk in, and he has 4 blankets over the top of him, and I can't see the blankets moving. Right? I thought I had a dead illegal in my apartment. And I thought, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? I mean, do I call the police? You know, what do you do? They're going to think I killed him or something. He's got 4 blankets over the top of him. He probably smothered or something like that. And so I go up to him, and I'm kind of scared, right? Because who wants to find a dead guy? And so I go up and I start calling him, and I shake the bed a little bit, and thank the Lord he popped up, you know? And so we start working with him. Now, he doesn't speak any language. Now, at that time, I was working with a drug rehabilitation center. And just some great guys, man. I had a great relationship with him. So I took him there because he couldn't speak language, but I knew that they would take care of him. And so he went and he stayed there. And he was brilliant. And he starts learning language really, really fast, right? So we can start to speak to him. Well, I start to talk to him. And he starts to tell me his story. And he tells me he comes from Mauritania. Now, Mauritania is all the way down the Sahara, just almost right before you get out of it. So to get to where we lived, he had to cross the Sahara Desert on foot, and then cross the mountains of the Atlas Mountains, which are pretty tall mountains, and he had to get to where we were living in the city of Malia. But he thought if he could just get there, he'd be safe. Now that was probably a 1,000-mile trip. Did it all by foot. And I said, well, why would you do that? You know, and the whole way he faced dangers. People were going to rob him, beat him, hurt him, kill him. He didn't know. Not to mention just crossing the Sahara Desert. Not a fun trip if you don't have a camel and water and stuff like that, right? So here he is crossing all the way over there. And he said, you know, John, in Mauritania, Islam is like an iron fist. He said, everybody I know is Muslim. He said, but you know what, John? I knew that Islam was wrong. I said, well, how'd you know that? He said, well, I investigated and I just knew in my heart. I knew in my heart as I sought for God, I knew in my heart that Islam was wrong. And so I told God, he said, I told God, I'm going to cross the Sahara Desert. I'm going to go to Malia. And he said, the first person I meet, Jew, Christian, whatever he is, that's what I'm going to become. Now imagine, you know, we had Jehovah's Witnesses, and we had Mormons, and we had Catholics, and we had Jews. We had all kinds of stuff in that city, as well as about 50,000 Muslims. And God brought him right to my doorstep. And I was the first person he met. And you know, that day I was tired, and all I wanted to do was relax and just rest a little bit. And God pricked my heart and said, John, you have to go talk to that guy. Now, I'm nothing special. I couldn't even talk to him. But I took care of him. And man, he came to faith. Because God brought him right to our doorstep. Isn't that cool? But it was because he sought God. See, he didn't know God. He didn't understand God. But he sought him out. And God availed himself to him. Man, it was just so amazing, so absolutely beautiful. And so we look at these peoples and we understand why it is that Paul had a passion for them and why we need to have a passion for lost people who don't have the opportunity to hear the gospel, because many of them are seeking to hear the gospel. I have a brand new Iranian friend here in town, and his name is Javid. Now, Javid, something happened to Javid when he was in Iran. He won't tell me about it. He said he was a 7-time national champion wrestler. And when he takes a hold of your hand, man, it almost hurts. He is powerful, but he won't tell me what happened to him when he was in Iran. And he's decided that there is no God because of what happened. And he is a devout atheist. He was telling me the other day, John, we just come from energy. And somehow energy came together and it created us. And And I said, well, you know, maybe energy's God. Well, you know, let's talk about this a little bit. He said, no, there is no God. He hates religion. Because he lived in a religion, in a place where to have questions meant you might go to jail or you might be killed. And so now we're loving on Javed and spending time with him and trying to get him to understand that we don't live religion. We live faith. We talk about Jesus. And so we have this passion for people. You know, the amazing thing is, as we read in verses 9 and 10, the gospel is simplistic. It says, if you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, then you will be saved. About 8 months ago, I was here in Louisville, and I got a phone call. And it was the wife of one of our pastors. And she said, John, I have somebody I need you to meet. And I said, okay. And so she's texted me his email or his phone, his name and his phone number. And so I gave him a call. His name was Zaidun. And Zaidun began to tell me his story. He got baptized 2 weeks ago. And I want you to see this baptism video. And then I'm going to tell you some more things about Zaidun.
When I come back to my home these days, I take my decision. I'm a quit. I'm a quit my college because I know though they guys won't kill me. When I come back to my home, I getting shot in here. 2005 and 2006, the situation in Iraq is very dangerous. Then I'm going to my college, Baghdad University, political science. I have a lot of conversation with people because those guys speak bad about the Christian and Jewish and Jesus. I know I visit a lot of country. I'm looking for which way, which religion, which God. I visit India, visit China, visit Malaysia, visit Turkish, visit Jordan, visit Lebanon, visit, I don't remember, a lot of. But my heart told me it take true way. They don't like me. They told me I'm involved, I'm kafir, because I have strange idea, because I'm search about the true. When I come back to my home these days, I take my decision. I'm a quit. I'm a quit my college because I know though they guys won't kill me. When I come back to my home, I getting shot in here. But Jesus saved my life. Just stay two days in hospital and come back to my home. I'm get decision, I'm quit Iraq. I'm moved to the Jordan. I was afraid in Jordan because when I can, for example, in the cafe, in the public area, I'm talk with any people, maybe they won't kill me. After Jordan, I came in here to America. I won't go to the church, but I'm afraid. Do you know why? Because I have idea. I'm ask Jesus, why you not like help me? I have voicemail. Hey, this is John, speak a little bit Arabic, but it's good. I want to talk to you about Bible. Oh my gosh. When I met with John in the coffee shop, John, he gave me information. He asked me why I believe Jesus. Why? I did not find one point same between Bible and Quran. No find one point. If you ask me now what my age, I told you my age is 3 or 5 months. Do you know why? Because I'm follow Jesus. I'm reborn in life. I believe Jesus is the God. I believe Jesus is killed on the cross. I believe Jesus is saved my life. I believe Jesus come back to life. When I take the baptize of the follow Jesus, the Muslims told me I'm kafir. Okay, if the like Muslim told me I'm kafir, I like I'm kafir because I'm follow Jesus. But if I ask my heart, I'm not kafir. I'm take true way because I believe.
Isn't that cool video? Man, that was like awesome. Zaidun has become a very good friend, and I don't know if that went on mute or not. It didn't. You hear his testimony. Come on. There we go. You hear his testimony, and I love it when he says, "You ask me my age, and I'm 3 to 6 months." You know, but to get to that place, what did he have to face? Man, somebody tried to kill him. You know, he faced persecution. This was before becoming a follower of Jesus. And now, since becoming a follower of Jesus, he faces even greater persecution if he tries to go back to Iraq. But you know, his heart's desire is someday to go back to Iraq, because he believes that many of the Iraqis, many of his friends, many of the people in Iraq are searching. They want to know the truth. And so when Paul says in Romans 10, 9 and 10, if you confess with your mouth, you know, for so many people in the world, to make that confession, Jesus is Lord, that's what he did there. That means that he's an infidel. He uses the word kafir. And in Islam, a kafir, an infidel, someone who converts, is someone who can be killed for his faith. His life can be taken. So he says, they call me kafir. I don't care if they call me kafir, because I know the true way. Man, you know, so many of us, when we came to faith, when we said Jesus is Lord, it didn't cost us much, did it? But you know, there are millions, billion people, it might cost them everything. We're working again in the country of Mauritania. And one of our missionaries that was there was working with some folks from Tennessee. One day they went to disciple some believers. And the missionary from Tennessee, the guy, he got there first. And Al-Qaeda was waiting for him. They tried to kidnap him, and he fought, and they killed him. Police immediately came and arrested every single Christian that we knew. Took our family that was there and put them under house arrest, and were brutal to them. I mean, they were just mean. They didn't hurt them, but they were mean to them. But the believers, they put in jail, and they began to beat them and abuse them and tried to get them to confess that they had killed this man. Because obviously they were kafirs. They were infidels. And only an infidel would do something like that. And the FBI, the American FBI, steps in whenever something like that happens with an American. And they quickly establish the fact that, in fact, it was Al-Qaeda who had done that. Well, so they released, in a sense, they released all of the believers. And they kicked our family out. They told them they were no longer, like, I'm no longer in Morocco. They could no longer come to Mauritania. We didn't know what happened to the believers, but we knew that they had been taken by their families and they had been put in villages, home villages. And it was the job of the imam, the mosque preacher, to convert these guys, these men and women, back to Islam. Some of the folks who'd become believers were wives and moms. We had some guys go back in about a year ago. This happened about 2 years ago. So about a year later, they went back in and they found one of the ladies. This woman, she had, when she was, before everything happened, she was married, she had kids, she had a big house, she had her own business. She was doing well. And she was sharing her story. And so when all of this happened, her husband had been shamed. So he divorced her immediately, took her kids, threw her out of the house. She began to live in just this one-room squalor of a place where she had to share a bathroom with 10 other people. And I mean, just a miserable, miserable existence. And remember, she was a wealthy woman. As she was talking to our friends, they said, she was telling them about her story. And she said, you know, the other day I saw an old friend. on the street. Somebody that I'd done business with, a female and another woman, and she said to me, she said, "Look at you. You've lost everything. You've lost your husband. You've lost your kids. You've lost your house. You've lost your business. You've lost everything to follow this Jesus. Convert back to Islam and you'll get it all back." Now imagine you've lost everything. And somebody says, "Just convert back to Islam and you'll get it all back." Temptation would be pretty great, wouldn't it? Temptation would be pretty strong to say, "You know what? It was better. I had food to eat every day. I had my own bathroom. I had my own house. I had my own business. I had my own money. I could do whatever I wanted." Temptation would be pretty big. But she looked our guys in the eye and she said, "But you know what? I said Jesus is Lord. And for me to say Jesus is Lord, it means something." And she said, "You know what? Everything I suffer with is worth it for the sake of the gospel." So when Paul says, "If you confess me as Lord, it means something." That means that my whole life is His. And I happily offer it as He's Lord because I believe in my heart that He raised from the dead. And I know that He lives. And I know that He lives in me. And so we see in this passage, we see Paul saying that if we confess with our mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in our hearts that God raised Him from the dead, then we shall be saved. And salvation means everything, you guys. There is nothing that this world can offer you all that is worth more than your salvation. There is nothing that this world can offer. Everything that is offered here is temporary. It's short. It's vanity. And it'll all go away. It'll all go away. These guys, they understand that sometimes better than we do. But then Paul says to us in verse 14, "Well, how will they call on Him in whom they have not believed? And how will they believe in Him in whom they have not heard? And how will they hear without a preacher?" Now we read that sometimes and we think, "Oh, well, that's the job of our pastor, obviously, the preacher, right?" But that's not what the word means there. It's just the one who goes and tells. You don't have to be a preacher to go and tell. "How they preach, how will they tell unless they are sent? Just as it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring the good news." Yes?
I have a question.
Uh-huh.
About the people who are, that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you get to be that person that shares the gospel with someone for the first time, man, that is like the coolest, funnest thing in the whole wide world. I remember one time we were in this village and we had some folks from Paducah. Anybody from Paducah in here? Nobody from Paducah? Okay, we had a team from Paducah, from Lone Oak Baptist Church, and they had come, and we'd put this fence up around the school system, and it happened to enclose the mosque. I didn't really want to enclose the mosque, but we kind of got stuck doing it, but I thought, oh well. And so we built this fence, spent a week digging ditches and putting up fence posts. You know, I have a PhD from Southern Seminary, and never did anybody ever teach me to dig a ditch. Like the biggest fault in my education. So we're digging these ditches and all this sort of stuff, The next week we go back because we'd left some work. We couldn't finish it all up, so we'd left some work. So we were going to make sure everything was done and stuff like that. And I had a guy with me, one of the guys that I work with, and I love this guy. He's just one of my best friends, just a brother to me. And the mosque preacher says, "Hey, we want you to come into the mosque." Now, it's illegal in Morocco to go into a mosque. There are just some weird laws. And he said, "No, I want you to come into the mosque." And so we've been in several mosques as a result. And so we go into the mosque with him. He says, I want you to eat lunch with me. So we sit down with the mosque preacher. Now, to be a mosque preacher, you have to memorize the entire Quran. All right, so it's about the size of the New Testament. And the only way you can be a pastor is to memorize the whole thing in Arabic, right? So it'd be like if any of you guys are thinking about going into ministry, you have to memorize the whole New Testament. And that was your ordination, right? That's how you become that. So he's well-versed in the Quran. And Ron, who I'm with, he decides that since we're with a mosque preacher, this would be a great time to talk about the Trinity and try and work out some thoughts about the Trinity. Now, you guys know that Muslims believe that Jesus is just a man and that to believe in the Trinity means you believe in three gods, right? And so I almost slapped Ron to try and talk about the Trinity with a mosque preacher on the very first visit with this guy. And, you know, the guy's like, I mean, he's just feeding off that. Well, yeah, you guys believe in three. No, we don't believe in three gods. He said, yes, you do. You believe in God the Father, God the Son, and Mary. And I thought, where'd Mary come in? And in the Quran, they believe that Mary is the third God. And they don't think about the Spirit. And when they say, no, there's the Holy Spirit in there. And so we're going on, and it's a lot of fun, actually. But we're like getting nowhere because the guy's quoting Quran to us, and we're quoting Bible to him. And, you know, it's crazy. But we're having a good time together. And pretty soon we say, hey, listen, can we share what God's done in our lives? And we share our testimonies with them. And whenever we would share our testimony, we share a gospel passage because I don't want to just base it off my testimony. I want to get to God's word. So I shared my testimony. And when I do it, I share the story of Cornelius. You know, Cornelius was a righteous man. He was a good man. He prayed. He gave his alms. He did all the right things. And God sent an angel to Cornelius and said, Cornelius, you need to find Peter. Peter has something to tell you. So he sent for Peter, and Peter comes and he tells him about Jesus. So I shared that story with him. I said, I want to tell you about Jesus. Because you're a good man. You do all the right things. You pray 5 times a day. You do all the right things, but you need to know about Jesus. And he sat there and he let me tell him about Jesus. This man had never heard the truth about Jesus. He didn't come to faith that day, man. He has a long way to go. But what a privilege it was to sit in that mosque and tell that man about Jesus Christ. So when the passage says, when it says to us, it says, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring the good news of good things. It's not that our feet are pretty, right? It's not that we have pretty feet. But it's that we have great privilege. We have great privilege to go and to tell people about Jesus Christ. And when you get to be that first person, man, it's amazing. It's amazing when they sit and they listen and they hear the gospel for the first time. And you see God's word start to penetrate their life. Start to move.
I'm not sure why I came here.
In understanding. I want to show you one last video. This is something that you guys can do as you get older. And some of you right now can go and do this type of thing.
I came here spiritually drained. I came here very honestly pessimistic. I felt like I didn't have anything to give, but that all changed once we entered the slums.
When I first entered into the slum, like, my mindset was just instantly just shocked. Just, this is not real. This is not how people live. There's no way possible. And from that, it's been really amazing to think back to how Jesus walked into these places where nobody else wanted to walk into. People were deserted and cast off in society. And then thinking of that mindset and having that mindset and going into these people and loving on them and thinking like, here's all I have to offer is Jesus Christ.
As we've gone from shack to shack in the slums here in India, and to see that people are really hungry. I mean, family after family coming and saying, we want to know about this God. We want to know about eternity. It's also increased my boldness because it's being received.
Seeing people accepting Jesus is amazing. It has really strengthened my faith. And I think our entire team now can see how our one life the one life we have been given can make a difference.
I've seen one life make a difference here in India just by sharing the love of Christ with people, showing compassion to people who are forgotten.
Our love for people shows our love for God. And so by loving these people, we love God.
I think we all struggle with the same questions. What am I living for? What's this life all about? I want to make a difference. I want my one life to matter.
And are we being very cultural Christians and okay with just living our lives for ourselves? Or are we truly humbling ourselves, just as Christ humbled himself, to go to these nations and say, yes, this is my Jesus Christ, and he's wanting to be your Jesus Christ, and he is your God, he's my God. There's no distinction between that.
I mean, I'm an optimist now, honestly. Based on my week here and what I've seen, they just want to know who God is. They want to know about this Savior. They're yearning for something real. If somebody comes here, they don't even have to come here with a whole lot of talent. The people are just hungry for love, and everybody can show love.
All right. I like it. It says we have one life. What are you going to do with yours? I'm going to tell you guys, I wouldn't trade my 22 years, my 18 years in North Africa. I wouldn't trade that experience for anything in the world. I wouldn't trade sleeping on cement floors under four wool blankets in the middle of winter with a stocking cap on my head, freezing to death, for anything in this world. Because I got to be those feet that shared the gospel with people for the first time. I got to be those feet who saw these people who were so hard to the gospel soften and eventually come to an understanding of Jesus Christ. Man, I can't think of a better way to live your life than sharing the gospel with people who've never heard. And sharing the gospel sometimes with people who have heard but need to hear again. There's nothing greater. There's nothing better. Do you guys have any questions for me? All right, well listen, yes.
Mm-hmm. The areas that you were in, whenever missionaries go into different countries, they're like at different levels as far as how they can openly share the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
What was your threat level?
Well, we were a level 3, so it's levels 1, 2, and 3. Level 1 is wide open. You go to Spain, Mexico, it's a level 1. We were level 3, the highest level. But that gets a little bit miscommunicated sometimes. We had high security, so I'll use a pseudonym. You know, you saw on the sheet that my name's spelled wrong. It's actually K-L-A-A-S-S-E-N. So we have a lot of security, but that didn't mean that we didn't have openness to share the gospel. What we have found is that where we thought it was hardest to share the gospel, sometimes it's most wide open. You can't go in the middle of town and set up a podium and preach. You know, but when you get into somebody's house, oh, I wanted to tell you one thing. You were asking about those little house churches, right? So when people start to come to faith, you help them set up churches, right? And, you know, when people come to faith, they get excited, right? So we had this one house church, and we had this guy. He was a gardener and a shepherd, mostly a gardener. And he was Chris Tomlin, right, of the Middle Atlas Berbers. But he didn't sound like Chris Tomlin, just saying, man. But he loved to write music. And so they would go into this house and they would put pillows in all of the windows so the sound didn't get out. And they would shut the doors real tight and then they would cut loose. It was some of the most awful sound and stuff I had ever experienced in my life. Because when Arabs sing, they sing off a key, so it's either sharp or flat. They love it. They think it's the greatest sounding thing in the world. But man, to my ears, it's like, oh my gosh. And they would sing at the top of their lungs because they just love Jesus. So sometimes you got to put pillows up in the windows so that not everybody can hear. But man, you do it. And it's amazing how open people really are, even in those hardest places. Iran. All of those believers that we saw, they're in Iran. There's an amazing thing, an amazing work of God going on right now in Iran. You know, a bunch of believers were just, we are assuming were just martyred for their faith in North Korea. You know why they were martyred for their faith? Because the church is exploding in North Korea. So, you know, sometimes those level, high threat level areas, God's doing amazing things in those places. That's a great question, though. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes?
How long were you a missionary?
We were 18 years in North Africa.
Mm-hmm. I lived 9 years in India. My parents.
Oh, fantastic. Wow, that's really cool. All right. India's a great place. Really great place. Mm-hmm.
What organization were you?
I was with the International Mission Board at the Southern Baptist Convention. Mm-hmm. And that, so that One Life, that's a product of the IMB, of the SBC. So if you're Southern Baptist, you can do One Life. They have great programs for youth. The International Mission Board does. But if you're not Southern Baptist, you can go through organizations like Pioneers. I highly recommend Pioneers. If you're not Southern Baptist, Pioneers is an outstanding organization where you're well cared for, and God is doing amazing things through Pioneers. I highly recommend them. If you're Southern Baptist, I highly recommend the International Mission Board. That's your sending agency. So I highly recommend it. It's outstanding. But Pioneers, if you're not Southern Baptist, incredible. IMB if you are Southern Baptist. Anything else? Any other questions? Yes. Yeah, well, study, you know, nobody, I've never met a missionary who said, I have too much education. I have met missionaries who say, I don't have enough. So study, you need to go on to college. You need to do some master's level work. You know, when you go to these places, you start church. There is no church. So one of the big questions that we had when some believers came to faith is, how do we baptize them? So we're in a high restricted access nation. Do we just take them out in public and baptize them? They might get killed if you do that. Well, so how do we do it? Do we sprinkle them? Well, we're Baptists. We can't sprinkle them, right? So one guy said, well, we'll take really big buckets and get them really, really wet, right? And well, you know, I don't know, because then for the rest of eternity, they're dumping buckets on each other, right? Well, you can't do that either. So we had to work through those questions and say, so what do we do? And so we found a place where we could take them to a pond or lake, and we submersed and we baptized them. And it was an incredible experience. But you know, when you do it, you're setting the tone for the church for the next 50 years, 100 years. So it's good to know what you're doing, you know? And so get that education. But spend time over in the summer overseas. I've got a young girl that she's a freshman in college. She's going to go spend a month in Tunisia with some of our people and have an incredible experience and be sharing the gospel. So you can be doing that now. Don't not do it now. Zaidun, my friend, when he was in Jordan, I'll let you go here with this one thing I want you to think about. When he was in Jordan, the Muslims said, Christians are going to come to your door. When they come to your door, lock it. Don't let them in. Now remember, he was searching for God, right? He was pumped. He could not wait to come to America so Christians would come and knock on his door and invite him to church. He sat for 9 months waiting for somebody to come knock on his door, and nobody came. You know, it's not just going overseas. Sometimes it's going next door to that guy that you think, oh man, he's a Muslim, he's not interested, but he's waiting for this Christian to come knock on his door because the Muslims told him they would, you know? And he was going to open it wide open. He couldn't wait, and they didn't come. So God in his provident grace put a piece of trash on his doorstep. The piece of trash was for a free Bible. He rode away for the Bible. It's so funny when he tells the story. They sent him a Bible. And he said, John, he said, I still had a problem. He said, I still had a problem because it was in English and I couldn't understand English. So I wrote them again and they sent me you. And I was able to share the gospel with them. That's right. So thank you guys for being here. God bless you. If there's anything I can do for you, I'm always available to you here at Boyce College where I teach. Okay? God bless.